everyone, and welcome to the New Gamer Nation podcast. I'm your host, Pilot, and with me today is Trevor.
Hello.
And Minnie.
Hey.
So I'd like to welcome everybody back. We apologize for the length of time in between podcasts. We were affected by the recent hurricane to our area, but we are back up and running and ready to move forward. So we would like to thank everybody for tuning in again. And let's just jump into it like we normally do with what we are playing. So why don't you start us off, Trevor, and let us know what you've been up to.
Well, I've been all over the place this week playing PC games, PS2, GameCube, really just going crazy when it comes to gaming. But most recently, I started playing Tropico 4, playing Tropico 3 the past couple weeks, just getting myself revved up and ready for it. And finally, on the 26th, Tropico 4 came out, and I got it, And it's definitely met my expectations. I've been playing the campaign mode. Normally I like to just play the sandbox and create my own nation and see how long before my people throw me out or try to kill me. But this time I'm actually playing the campaign. It's about 22 levels and it's extremely hard. I spent all day yesterday on level 2. I really didn't think it was going to take me that long to beat one level, but it's just as expansive and difficult as it is in sandbox, but there's 22 levels of it. So I've been playing that for on live games. I know we've been talking about the streaming service on live. I've been playing Fear 2. I have not played Fear 1, so I'm sort of playing catch up on the background story on, you know, the crazy little girl Alma killing and ripping people apart. I don't really know why she's doing that, but I'm sort of seeing the aftermath of the event from the first one, and they kind of give you flashbacks. So I'm getting a good feel for what is comparable to other survival horrors like Dead Space or Silent Hill. And I've been enjoying that. I was really enjoying it because I was shooting real people. And the last scene of the game, I started getting attacked by like these crazy mutants and it freaked me the heck out. So now I feel like I'm playing Silent Hill and the game's scaring me. So I kind of have been taking a break from that. And then the final two games that I've been playing are older retro games because I recently bought an old GameCube and an old PS2. So I'm playing the remake of Resident Evil 1 on the GameCube, and that's awesome. They made it really scary. They added a lot of new zombies popping out of places where they never popped out of. You know, coming around corners thinking, oh yeah, when I did this last time, I was fine. And it's like, da-da-da, music goes off and two zombies come around the corner and it just really freaks you out. And then, for the PS2, I'm playing Final Fantasy X2 because I couldn't find X. So I'm playing X2 first and then I'll go and buy X and go from there. So that's pretty much it. I'm sort of all over the place and playing different systems and trying different things out, but I've been having a lot of fun playing the older games.
I was going to say, do you still find like Resident Evil scary despite the probable graphical limitations? Still effective?
Do I find... I actually don't think it has graphical limitations. The GameCube, amazingly enough, has really good graphics. Mm-hmm. And I was never a GameCube owner. The only game I ever played on GameCube before this was Luigi's Haunted Mansion. And it was horrible. It was the worst game I've ever played in my life. But it graphically looked pretty good. And the GameCube, when it came out, I believe was competing against the Xbox and the PS2. And it sort of got, it was a popular system, but I don't think it got the credit it deserved. And it had a bunch of titles on it, you know, Resident Evil 1, Resident Evil 4, Resident Evil 0, and other titles that I'm probably not really interested in because I only care about the Resident Evil series on the GameCube. But the game looks amazing. It definitely looks better than the Saturn version or the original PS1 version of Resident Evil 1.
Well, you're playing, is that Resident Evil 0?
Have I played it or am I playing it?
Well, are you playing it? Because isn't that what they call the remake of the first one?
No, they remade Resident Evil 1. So if you've ever played Resident Evil, the original game, Director's Cut on the PS1 or the original version that came out, they took that. They remastered it, they put it in HD because the GameCube can do 720p, and they added a bunch of new content. They didn't change any of the scenes or the storyline, but they added, you know, where things pop out, and for example, the scene where you go up to the mansion door when you first enter it, and you try to open the door and a dog's head comes to the door, and you're like, oh crap, there's a dog in the door. In this game, the dog actually jumps through the door and attacks you, and then you run around the lobby like a chicken with its head caught off, trying to get away from it. And so it's a little bit different. Now, Resident Evil Zero, which is another great game, it's the first Resident Evil co-op game. That was also made on the GameCube, and that takes you before Resident Evil 1 to before the Mansion incident, and it's a prequel. And it is superb, and I played that too.
Well, I was particularly interested in what you thought of the Tropico 4, how you think it differs from Tropico 3.
I actually find that it's very similar to Tropico 3.
Yeah, that's pretty much what I noticed too, because I was also playing Tropico 4.
It has the same weather system. It pretty much has the same rebel and, you know, civil disobedience, people protesting and all that, has that same system. They sort of touted we're adding more superpowers like China and the Middle East and the European Union. But when I go to my foreign relations office, I can't select those to be pro. I'm still forced into a Cold War era, and I have to choose whether to be pro-USA or pro-USSR. So I was disappointed in that. But what I really like is I like that they added ministries, and it kind of made it a little bit more official. And they added advisors, so I had people advising me. And it really reminds me of the SimCity series. And I love and I miss the SimCity series.
Yeah, well, I kind of felt the same way also. It seemed almost exactly like Tropico 3 in a lot of ways. I mean, there were subtle differences here and there, especially with new buildings that you can choose from that had, you know, similar effects than other buildings had. It just, you know, depending on whatever you chose. But it seemed pretty similar, but it didn't diminish that it was a good game nonetheless. You know, I just think that if you're looking for a completely different game or a completely updated game, that this doesn't necessarily do either.
It appeals to people who like the Tropico series.
Yeah, I'd agree with that for sure.
Basically, when I played the original Tropico 1 and I finished it, and I really liked it, but it had a lot of limitations. There are a lot of things that I didn't like about it. You know, there were limited buildings, things of that nature. And they came out with an add-on and added some more buildings. But I had to wait until Tropico 3 to really get any more of Tropico, because the Tropico 2 was Pirate Cove and had nothing to do with the Tropico series. And it was really dumb. It was like a pirate island. And now Tropico 4, I was really expecting a huge overhaul and for the game to just really become sort of like with Civilization, like a full diplomacy. Like I can actually make trade deals, imports and exports with China and the EU and Middle East. And I can, you know, I can be pro-Arab or, you know, like just go crazy. Because it doesn't make sense for a dictator elected as a fascist to be pro-USSR or pro-US. Like that's like Hitler saying, yeah, I love America, you know? It doesn't make sense. So I wanted it to be more realistic. And it didn't do that for me.
But being a Tropico fan yourself, how do you feel like the game appealed to you?
No, I think that as a fan, the added content is good. And I was definitely yearning more added content. Some of the new buildings are really, really cool. But yeah, but I think it adds to the brand, definitely. And it makes it, you know, I guess Tropico 3 was extremely popular. So it's really good for us players. I worry that it's not, you know, it's not going to reach other players and they're not going to be interested in it. They're just going to look at it and think, oh, it's just another real-time strategy game, or I don't know. What do you call those type of games, for the construction games?
Well, it's like a simulation game. City planning, you know.
City planning. And they're getting closer to that with the ministries and the advisors. And I got to talk about this. I like the foreign investment. And I can't remember, was that from Tropico 3, where a foreign country can open a factory in your country?
Well, they would send you investment, like money. They would give you money, and every, you know, year you would get $5,000 from the U.S. and $5,000 from Russia, that kind of thing. But I don't think it wasn't as expensive as it is now, because I know, like, you can link up with certain, you know, industry people, and they'll say, oh, I want you to supply me with lots of trees or lots of, you know, canned fish or whatever, and they'll pay you bonuses as you get closer and closer to providing them with what they want or what they need.
What I do think is good for first-time players is that they added objectives and missions. The past games, and I played the open mode a lot, where I would just build a random map and build a random country. And, you know, one time I'd be a fascist, one time I'd be a communist, or I'd be a leftist author, benevolent dictator or something. But I was, you know, just doing things on whim, and there was really no clear direction. But now with objectives and suggestions, if I'm sitting around doing nothing, I get a little pop-up that says, you know, maybe you should feed your people. Maybe you should build some houses because your people are living in shacks. And it's like, oh, thank you, Penelope, my random advisor. I am grateful towards you. And I think that really, it makes it a lot easier. It makes it so the game is a little bit more linear, so you actually have a goal in mind. But, you know, I love building a nation that expands an entire island that has, like, you know, like a huge prison colony on one side of the island, you know, industry on the other, and a huge concentration of military in the middle. Like, I'm just crazy when I build a game or when I do a new game. But you know, I like it.
So what about your feelings on Final Fantasy X2? I mean, that one was particularly controversial, following up one of the better-received Final Fantasies of the series.
Final Fantasy X2 is the worst Final Fantasy game I've ever played in my life.
Well, there you go. That's the, wow.
It's is that cut and dry enough for you?
Yes, that sounds pretty decisive.
First of all, I can tell you right off the bat why it's controversial. It's the first game where the lead characters are all girls. There is no male lead in the game, and it's basically the Powder Puffs. Like, you are going to save the world. Yeah. And, like, they keep jumping up in the air, and they're all excited, and they all change their dresses all the time. And I feel like I'm playing, like, Barbie's Final Fantasy. It's just, they could have been a lot more serious. Like, it's actually really cool that you're a girl and you're playing Yuna from Final Fantasy X, but they totally went the girl power direction. Like, they were making up for 12 years of not having strong female characters or strong female leads.
I thought you just said they were making out for 12 years.
I was like,
that is not the sort of female role models we need.
No. You know what I mean, though. They're making up for
Sorry.
It.
Yeah, got it. Making up for
and
it.
They were trying too hard. And the game has no enemy, virtually no enemy. And the whole point of the game is to collect spheres or video of things that happened. Like, they're memories that people filmed with a camera. And you're called Sphere Hunters. And that is the entire purpose of the game. And you just revisit old locations from Final Fantasy X. And, you know, and you meet people from Final Fantasy X that I have no idea who they are because I haven't played the game yet. So I think it's just a game to complement Final Fantasy X. And it really doesn't stand on its own very well.
Here, allow me to fill in because I've played and completed both games. And X2 is pretty much a game on its own. It has very little to do with 10.
Okay.
Aside from borrowing characters, because Yuna, Riku, and Luna all came from X, and they're all part of your party in X.
Mm-hmm.
And then they just kind of, you know, once X ends, then that's it. Now they kind of brought these characters back, and this takes place after X, and you see, like, you know, Yuna's like a rock star or whatever she is. And, like, you all kind of come together and, you know, go on this weird adventure. But, like, it doesn't do anything particularly well enough to expand the X series. Because, you know, X on its own was, like, one of the best Final Fantasy games of the series.
Mm-hmm.
And personally, it's my favorite. You know, I felt that the game did such an excellent job of kind of conveying spirituality that you kind of felt a reverence for the religion that they were practicing in Final Fantasy X, even though it's completely fictional.
Yevon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Yevon. Yeah, exactly. The Yevon religion. It's completely fictional. It's all made up. But yet, with the reverence that they show to the religion and the temples and things like that, it kind of makes you feel that way also about it. And, you know, it, it conveyed emotion pretty strongly. And then you get to X2, and it's a complete departure for the series. Like you said, it's very Japanese, almost to a fault, you know, where they said, instead of Americanizing it a little bit and kind of toning down some of those crazy Japanese elements, they just left it all in there. And these characters are acting in ways that, you know, you would know that they would do something like that, but you didn't really see that in X.
And that's the thing, the lack of seriousness in the game and kind of like the happy-go-lucky behavior. Like when I get on, every time we go back to the airship has disco music playing, and it just doesn't feel like, you know, I'm coming from Tactics. I'm coming from Seven. I'm coming from Death, Murder, you know, World Destruction. That's the Final Fantasy I like. And it's kind of just too fun, I guess, is the word I'm looking for it. But what you're saying, like, and correct me if I'm wrong, if I played Final Fantasy X, would X2 feel more, you know, would I feel more reverence towards it, or would I appreciate it more?
No, you'll probably hate it more because it's a complete departure.
Yeah, okay.
It's completely different. Like, Yuna in X is very reserved, especially in the beginning of the game, because she's a priestess. Her whole job is a summoner, and being a priest is being a summoner in the game. You know, as Yuna, you have to visit all these temples, and you have to pray to the gods. And when you pray to the gods give you the gift to summon a creature, and that's how you get your summons. And that's what that's all about. But then all of a sudden she goes to X2 and she puts on a crazy cocktail dress and she's, you know, it's rock star time. Let's go. And it doesn't make any sense.
She's an international superstar, but she used to be the most powerful grand summoner. And what aggravates me so much playing this game, because I've already put in about 30 hours into the game, is that I can't be a grand summoner. I haven't been able to summon anything. And
nope, there are no summons.
There's no summons. There are guardians, or they call them Aeons in this game. But, you know, they've been Eidolons, guardians, Aeons. But I can't summon them. And I have to collect dress spheres. And I don't even want to go through the trouble of describing or explaining what a dress sphere is, because it took me forever to figure out what it was. But it's just basically a mechanism for, I guess, jobs or having it being a mage or...
Yeah, it's your class.
It's basically, yes, it's for equipping classes, different classes. And within a dress sphere, you can basically, and this is the one interesting thing about the game, you can basically be a multi-spec fighter in your sphere. So you start the battle as a warrior, and then you can end the battle as a priest. You can start the battle as a gun runner, or whatever they call it, a gunner, and then you can end the battle as a berserker or a dark knight. And there are some really cool dress spheres. I went out and I acquired berserker and dark knight, which are the best dress spheres and the most rare. But it's just very confusing and very different than anything I've played before in the Final Fantasy series.
Yeah, well, it works completely different also. I mean, it's a different game altogether. You know, X is a very traditional Final Fantasy RPG. I mean, you play Final Fantasy VII, it's very similar to Final Fantasy X in the way that it controls. And, you know, one person is one thing and that's it. You know, Yuna's the summoner and that's it. I mean, you can teach her other stuff, but she's only going to be good at summoning. And, you know, each person has their own role and that's how they play out. And where X2 comes in is anybody can be anything at any time. It just depends on what they're wearing. So if they're wearing the mage, like the black mage suit, then they're going to start leveling up being a black mage. And the longer you leave them in the black mage suit, the better they get at being a black mage until you max it out. And then you could either, you know, continue using her as a black mage and that's it, or put a different dress on her and she becomes a gun mage or a white mage or whatever. So it just works completely different. It's like a completely different game, but it just didn't feel right, especially coming right after X. It just didn't do it for me.
I feel like I've missed out. I never had a PS2. I've always wanted to play these games, all the Final Fantasy series, because I've only played 13. But is it weird to think, like, you say there's only the three girls. There are three girl protagonists, right?
In X2.
In X2. Because I just looked them up, and it shows you how badly I'm, like, indoctrinated into Japanese, like, character design, in that I thought Pain was a boy. That's bad.
Every time I play the game, I think Payne's name is Blaine. Like, oh yeah, Blaine's gonna do this. Like, oh wait, Payne. Cause I think she's a boy and she looks like a boy. Like all
usually we complain about how girls, how Japanese character boys always look like girls, and this time I'm complaining the other way. Whoops.
No, you're right. It's actually the other way around. But what you're saying about the PS2, about not having one, is exactly what I did. Growing up, my parents didn't buy me any systems. I had to scrounge money together. And I basically only had a Game Boy Color and a PS1. When I saw a PS2 for $25 at the secondhand store, I picked it up. I grabbed X2. And now I have Final Fantasy VII Dirge of Cerberus and Final Fantasy XII sitting on my shelf waiting to be played. So I'm trying to basically make up for my lost childhood, I guess.
Yeah, I want to do that. I don't know if I'd play any other. I want to play Shadow of the Colossus. That's on PS2, isn't it?
Just wait for the remake.
I'll do that. But I've always wanted to play the original Final Fantasies because that's just sort of like an integral part of a gaming education.
Well, Final Fantasy 1 through 6, they're really hard to play because they're, like, if you ever played Zelda on the Game Boy, the original Game Boy, it's like just walking around, pulling up grass and fighting guys in a 2D environment. And that's how all of them are. Like, I'm playing Final Fantasy 1, and it's really fun and it's simplistic. You're basically the four heroes, the four prophesized or the, yeah, four heroes that was prophesied would come and restore the four crystals to their glory. Like that's pretty much the only thing you have to do. You just have to re-energize the crystals. So it's very simplistic and you can probably get through them quickly, but they're nothing like Final Fantasy 13 or I haven't played 12 yet, but I assume 12 is good and 7 and the rest of them.
I'd like to play 10. I think that's the one I've heard most about and the one that looks
10. Yeah, play 10. 12.
Especially good.
12 is, I didn't like 12.
12, everybody, everything I've seen on 12 is that it was terrible and it was a horrible game. But everything I've watched, I understand there are no random battles. You don't get sucked into the battle.
No.
It's very reminiscent of Chrono Trigger on the PS1. Chrono Cross on the PS1. You can actually avoid enemies by running around them.
Well, you can and you can't. Final Fantasy XII was the first Final Fantasy where they took away the turn-based elements and went to more of an action RPG.
Mm-hmm.
You see all the enemies around, and yes, technically you can avoid most of them, but the problem is when you get to the bosses, because now there's bosses like everywhere, and they prevent you from moving forward on the map. So you'll explore this area, everything's great, and you figure, I'm tired of fighting, so you just run to the boss. The boss is going to whoop you really, really bad. So then you have to go back and start grinding.
Yeah.
And grinding and grinding and grinding. And that's all that it is just nonstop grinding. I started this game the day it came out, and I'm still not finished with it because of how much grinding it is.
Well,
I've put in over 100 hours, and I'm still not powerful enough to take on some of the bosses that I'm fighting.
Seriously? Yikes.
It is insane.
Wow, I wish I had read that before I went.
Do not like. Yeah, that's weird.
Well, I like grinding. I like leveling up.
Within reason, though.
Like, if you want to sink, 150 hours into the game, go right ahead. It's a good game. Like, the story is good. It's just a big time commitment, and it's disappointing because the story is good and you're trying to play it and you can't.
Do you have any comments on the Dirge of Cerberus?
I didn't play the Dirge of Cerberus yet, but I have heard good things, and I've heard that the ending is one of the better endings of video games in general. Like, I heard it was just awesome, and especially if you played 7 and you're familiar with the characters,
I am.
They all kind of have a piece in it of this.
I was watching the video, and as soon as I saw Tifa and obviously Vincent's the main character, I saw Cid and, all the original characters, I had to get it.
And there's also a movie, too, that supplements the game, so.
Well, I'll have to watch that before I play it.
There's like a little animated movie in the same computer-generated graphics, kind of like the movie Final Fantasy, like that style of graphics. There's a little movie like, about that.
Like the Spirits Within or Advent Children?
Like the Spirits Within.
Spirits Within.
Yeah, that style graphic, but it's the Dirge of Cerberus. But let's head over to you, Minnie, since we went off on a crazy tangent.
No worries.
Yeah, but why don't you let us know what you've been up to?
Well, today I've managed to both simultaneously finish Mass Effect 1 for the second time round and start Mass Effect 2. And Mass Effect 1, even like second time round, was such a good game. It's definitely one of my favorites. It's just the combination of like the characters and the morality and even like the graphics, like the final, if you've played Mass Effect 1, sort of when you're in the final couple of scenes before you sort of get to the, you know, you finish the game and like you're in the Citadel and you're in this big spaceship basically, and the sort of the graphics are just amazing and it feels incredible. But I finished that again. I really finished it more so on my new Xbox so that I could, I used to play it on my brother's old Xbox before I decided to actually branch out. So I played it again so that I could import my character onto Mass Effect 2, which I haven't played yet. So now that I managed to do that, I started Mass Effect 2, and again, it just feels like starting it, it feels like it fits you like a glove. Like you've played Mass Effect 1 and it feels so comfortable to be back, but at the same time the tone has changed so much, and it feels a lot, it actually feels a lot darker, and I'm only just getting into it, but already like it hits you really hard. The plot hits you hard in the first sort of 10 minutes really, and it feels, there's so much gravitas like around it. God, it's such a good game. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to getting through that because I'm ready for Mass Effect 3. Definitely wanting to start that. I'm waiting for that.
You didn't even get through 2 and now you're already going on 3?
I know. Well, that's sort of why I had to get my button gear, because, you know, all the Mass Effect 3 was coming out and I was watching all these screenshots and all of these demos. And I was like, oh, it looks amazing. And I love Mass Effect 1, so I'd already played it by that point, but just not played through a second time. And I love Mass Effect 1 so much, I was like, I've got to be ready for Mass Effect 3. So hence, I've now got 2 weeks before I go to university to pretty much complete Mass Effect 2 before I go. So that should be fine.
Well, I hope you're bringing your Xbox with you.
Well, I am, but I'm just, the course I'm doing, because I'm doing veterinary medicine, so it's quite full on, and I'll be there for 5 years, and there's a lot of work to be done, so my Xbox is definitely coming with me, no doubt, but I just don't know how much time I'll have once I get there, which really hurts, really breaks my heart. And also, I won't be able to take my TV, because I'm a bit of a saddo, let's face it, but I specifically bought a TV just for gaming, basically. It was a lovely big screen and I saved up for it for ages. And I don't know if it's going to fit in my university hall room, so that's a bit of a bummer.
Oh, priorities, you know, TV first, and you fit in everything else around that.
Exactly. Do I want to actually write essays on a desk, or do I just want to use it to house my big TV? I don't know. It's a tough one.
So you can flip the TV over and write on that. It's fine.
Yeah, I will really miss it. I've become a bit of a TV snob in the interim now, because it was such, like, playing on a big screen is such an experience. It feels like HD. It really feels amazing. So to have to downgrade again, I would be really sad.
Oh, it will be, I'm sure.
But hopefully I won't have to. Fingers crossed.
So how do you feel that those two games interface? Do you think the flow between the games is good, or do you think there's too much of a shock in between the mood and the tone?
Well, it does feel a little different, actually. So I think as soon as you turn it on, even like gameplay wise and like interface, even the interface is different, which obviously is to be expected, but it does feel very new, even though, you know, you're sort of continue on with the same character. So, but I think they've managed to do it quite well, because everything in Mass Effect feels so researched. I mean, I know it's all science fiction, but everything feels so tight, like all the storyline and the characters and all the theory and sort of science, obviously is a little bit far-fetched, but it all feels very well sort of knitted together. So everything feels, it doesn't matter how differently they change sort of the storyline, or they haven't changed it, but they've added a few new elements at the beginning of Mass Effect 2 that feel really like, it hits you really like quite shocking. And it feels, but it still feels really in line with the series. And it's just, yeah, it's just really exciting, and it doesn't really, It changes, but it still feels quite natural. It feels like you put it in and the menu pops up and it feels like you're back home. It feels good to be back in the universe again. So they do work well together. And I'm also, sorry, I'm playing one more if you want to hear about that.
Go on.
Yeah, no, a couple of weeks ago, basically story behind why I have this game. A couple of weeks ago, a friend came around to my house, 3 a.m, got really drunk, was sick all over my floor. And then as an apology for that, he bought me Batman Arkham Asylum. So he really knows how to get back on my good side. So I've just started playing as well, Batman, and I never got it first time around. Sort of, I don't really know much about the Batman universe. I'm not a comic reader. I've seen the films and things, so I know. I think everyone grows up like with a general overview of the comic book characters. I don't know how we know, but we do know. So I know the general premise of Batman, And this game, actually, I'm only a couple of hours in, but it's really, really good. The atmosphere really works. Like when you're taking Joker down to the asylum, and he's just completely insane, and you know something's not going to go well. But it's a really good atmospheric game, which I can imagine is probably quite in line with the series. Not that I'm really very qualified to say, but it's that's a really fun game. And the fighting, like, oh my god, punching people has never been so fun. Just take people out big time.
Oh, that was the big seller for the game. I mean, yes, the atmosphere is very close to the Dark Knight side of Batman, which is, let's face it, the favorite Batman that everybody loves, which is why the new movies have been so popular.
They were good.
With Christian Bale, because it's all based around that Dark Knight side of Batman.
Yeah, it's really good. It feels pretty natural in line with what I've seen. And but seriously, like, fighting is great. Enough punching people has literally never been so fun. I could do that all day.
So you're probably looking forward to the sequel, Batman Arkham City.
I've only played a couple of hours of Arkham Asylum, but I'm eager to finish and eager to get the story and get into it. So definitely, I think I'll be one for Arkham City.
Yeah. Have you been collecting all the clues and things like that?
Yeah, so far I spent about 10 minutes trying to get into one room that I was like using my X-ray vision. I could not work out how to get into the room because I was trying to get those little. Well, I think they're the green someone. Ooh, I've already forgotten. Haven't played it for a while.
Yeah, the green question marks, yeah.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah, I was trying to find all of those because I like achievements and I like completion. But I didn't break into that room, so I just left to go and punch more people in the face. Priorities, obviously.
All right, so that's going to bring us to our first break. So stick around and we'll be back soon. Welcome back. So I did want to kind of cover one last thing before we move on to our first segment of the podcast, but I did want to talk a little bit about one of the games that I did play, aside from the normal Assassin's Creed Brotherhood multiplayer and Tropico 4, which I jumped in before. But I did play a game on Xbox Live called Rock of Ages, released by Atlus. And I don't know if any of you guys have played this, but it's a pretty interesting little game. Looks a lot like a Monty Python game with the graphics. But you play as Sisyphus, the Greek tragic character that was doomed to push a rock up the hill for eternity, and just when he gets to the top, it rolls back down to the bottom, and he's got to do it again. Well, Sisyphus has had enough nonsense from the underworld and decides to break out, and he breaks out, and that's where the game starts, and you kind of have to use your giant boulder to take out targets from history. And, you know, it's kind of like a very tongue-in-cheek, adventure-y kind of a game. You take on characters like Napoleon and Leonardo da Vinci and all these different kinds of characters, and you control the boulder itself, and you have to run it down this path and crash it into your rival's gates.
Is this like a boulder personified? Does it talk to you and stuff?
You control it where, you know, you direct where that ball goes. So if you want to roll the ball to the left, you just hold left on the analog stick and it rolls left.
I was hoping it was going to talk to you and stuff, and you have like a companion boulder.
The talking rock.
Yeah, who doesn't want a talking rock?
There's, funnily enough, there is no dialogue in the game at all.
Oh, wow.
Oh,
It's right out of, it's right out of the Monty Python kind of.
Mm-hmm. So how do they introduce their quirky stuff, like Napoleon and Da Vinci, without prefacing it with some words or, you know, some writing? I don't understand. They just pop up and you roll a boulder towards them?
Well, once you get out of Hades there, you follow a predetermined path, which kind of takes you to locations in Europe. As you get to certain locations, you'll all of a sudden be rolling the ball and you'll stop over Greece. And then all of a sudden you're taking on Leonidas from 300. And then it'll break into a little cutscene where you'll see the person you're about to take on, and he'll, you know, do a little act. You know, he'll come out of his castle and he'll yell at some people or whatever. He'll be charging at you on a horse. Like, he'll make some kind of a grand appearance.
Mm-hmm.
And then it'll go to a street fighter kind of a thing, and you'll see your guy on the left and then the guy you're fighting on the right. And it says, you know, Napoleon or whoever you're fighting. And then it just kind of goes from there. I mean, there is no, like, story per se where Sisyphus is trying to get to a certain location or trying to accomplish certain goals. I mean, he's just there, and he's just taking on all comers as he's moving through space and time.
Oh, interesting concept, I suppose.
Yeah. It's different.
It's definitely different because it kind of combines castle defense with platforming. The premise of the game is you're trying to stop the person you're battling against from getting to your walls as you're trying to get to his. So you set up your defenses, and then you roll your ball down his defenses. And it's a platformer because you control the ball directly, and you can, you know, make the ball jump, make it move left and right, you know, faster, slower. I mean, you have direct control over the ball. So it's definitely an interesting mix of dynamics. And, you know, the game itself is really pretty funny. It makes a lot of cultural references and jokes like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a pretty decent game. And, I just wanted to mention that and, you know, let everybody know everything that I've been playing. But, so let's just move right over to the first segment of the podcast, which has kind of been a hot topic recently, which is GameStop and the Deus Ex scandal. Just for those that haven't known what's been going on, Deus Ex has come out recently, and GameStop decided to sell PC versions of the game in their stores. They purchased copies and were going to sell them to the public and realized that there was a coupon for OnLive packaged into the game itself, where players can go and download Deus Ex for OnLive right from the consoles on OnLive, on the online service, and then get the console game for free. So GameStop was not very happy with that because they had just purchased a game streaming service themselves, and they did not want their competing service publicized. So what they did was broke the seals on the new games, pulled the coupons out, and put a sticker on it and sold the games as new for full manufacturer's suggested retail price. And that had caused quite a stir. So why don't you let us know what you've been thinking about this, Minnie, and give us your reaction to the story.
Well, I hadn't actually heard about this up until we talked about it a little while ago, because I'm pretty sure we don't have a GameStop in England. I've never, ever seen one. But, so first I've heard of it, and my initial reaction is actually that's pretty off. It doesn't sound right. It doesn't sit right with anyone, I don't think, because I've been reading about, there was a memo sent out, and it was literally, please just break it in, remove it, so that no one will have to, our desire is not to have the coupon go to any customers. So that just smacks of like, we are very scared that our service is not as good as yours, basically. But it's not up to them what the developers are including in their game. That's purely the developer's choice. So if they wanted to include a coupon and GameStop are purposely ripping it out, that sounds very off. It's not actually providing a copy of the, he's not giving them original, and it's basically ripping them off. So I think that is a really, really bad move. And I wouldn't be happy if I was purchasing stuff from GameStop on a regular basis.
Well, let me add this corollary to what we had just said, and then you tell me what you think about that. Once GameStop was confronted about the situation, they immediately backtracked, allowed anyone who purchased the game to return the game for full price. Whatever they paid, they got back. And they got a gift card for $50.
Yeah, so, but that's also, I mean, that's clever, though, in a way, because they're like, okay, so we ripped the $50 coupon out of your game. You're angry, so you can come and give it back, and we will give you a $50 coupon from us, so you can buy more stuff from us. So it's a fair enough gesture. But still, that sounds really bad when you think about it.
Well, sure, it sounds bad, but do you think, would you be happy if you found out that a game you bought was not complete and this whole situation happened to you?
No, that would really, really annoy me, just because, like, I was meant to get a coupon that they basically stole from me. So I would not be happy, no.
All right, so what about you, Trevor? What are your feelings on the subject?
Well, I definitely would feel shortchanged. And we were saying this before, when I buy a game, I want to know that it's complete and that it's in the form that it was meant to be. You know, we haven't even talked about the fact there's probably an agreement between the developers of Deus Ex and OnLive, and I'm sure money was passed between the two of them. And that deal, that marketing agreement was just thrown out the window by this third party seller who I'm not even sure has the right to violate that product and go in and remove something from it. But I agree with what Minnie was saying about how it shows a lack of confidence in their own strength, in their own product, that they can't even allow their customers to get one measly little coupon that'll pay for, you know, it might pay for a few games on OnLive, sure, but it's not going to pay for two Deus Exes or two Arkham Cities or other major titles that are going to be on there. So I think that they completely overreacted by removing it. I think that they jumped the gun, or jumped the shark, as they say, because they don't even have their service out yet. It's still in beta testing. It's not even ready to compete with OnLive. So it kind of puzzles me that they did it. I understand their fear, because they're sort of in a quasi-dying industry of selling discs. And I'm sure we'll talk about this a lot more later in coming weeks, of how the gaming industry is changing. I don't know. I think they violated their trust with their customers.
Oh, well, I'll just get into my reaction really quickly. And, you know, personally, I just said, you know, this has got to be illegal. I mean, mm-hmm. if you think about these products as, say, grocery items, all of a sudden you go to buy a carton of eggs and the farmer just went in and took two of your eggs. And, you know, sold you the pack as if there was 12 eggs in it. It's like, you can't do that. Where's those other two eggs? You're paying for 12. Mm-hmm. Why is there only 10?
Yeah, effectively, and, you know,
People would go crazy over that.
Or someone removing the marshmallows from Lucky Charms.
Yeah, exactly. You know, just removing value from a package just is infuriating.
Yeah, it's not their right.
You know, it's not up to you to determine what's in the package. It's up to them to check the package to see what's in it. And they should say, hey, there's a coupon for a future competitive service. We probably don't want to sell these. And then just ship them back to Square Enix and say, hey, guys, we don't want to sell these because they got coupons in there for a competing service of ours. And just take these back and get rid of them somewhere else. And they could have done that. But instead, they're trying to be sneaky and make their money, too. And that's where the problems come in.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, let's play devil's advocate for a minute. You know, you're put yourself in a similar situation where, you know, you're some little guy who's just trying to get into a new business. And the products that you were selling before all of a sudden contain coupons for your competitors. You know, so say you own a grocery store and you're selling products and things like that. And you've always been selling Pepsi, but now all of a sudden you want to get into the soft drink business. So you go and you buy Coca-Cola, and now you own Coca-Cola, but you still have Pepsis in the store. Like, don't you want to get rid of all those Pepsis so you can start selling your Cokes? Like, doesn't that kind of make sense on a certain level?
Yeah, but it's still, like, I suppose in that sense. But were there other copies of the PC game of Deus Ex that came without the coupons? Like, was there an option to sell the ones without the coupon, or did every single one have a coupon? It wasn't like a pre-order thing or a special condition or a special, you know, edition of it. It was just every single one of them sold had this coupon in them.
Yeah, everyone had the coupon, sure.
Okay, so there was no option for GameStop to go, we don't want to promote them, so we'll buy, you know, X amount of a copy that doesn't have them in, because, you know, I thought it might be a special edition. Okay, well, in that case, they didn't really have an option but to sell, you know, their competitor's coupon. But I don't know, it still feels iffy with me, regardless of that. I mean, they are GameStop themselves. They're like I think they're the biggest selling company, or game company, at least. Possibly, they have like 6,000 branches worldwide. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think they don't. I don't know if they need to stoop to petty tactics such as ripping people off to make sure.
To your analogy, you were saying if they were a small time mom and pop or small time Joe Schmo, 6,000 stores is not small time. and you would think that they would know better than to do something like this. But then again, this is the company that will only pay you a $5 credit for returning a brand new, never opened game because you bought it from them previously, past 30 days, and they now consider it used. My friend and I actually tried to return a game. It was a month and a half after we bought it, still in the package in plastic. They would only give him $5 for the game. Ouch. And it was originally was $60. For a company that's willing to do that to its customers, to shortchange them and then turn around and sell that game for $20 or $30, which they do, I don't know. I don't think it's below them to do it. But to go to your devil's advocate point, they're trying to protect their bottom line. They're a living, breathing corporation in this country. They're a person. They need to survive, and they need to have money to feed themselves. And if you see a bigger, fatter, more attractive person coming down the line, you're going to kick him in the gut. Or you're going to put your foot out, right? And you're going to try to trip him.
Well, there's also another thing to consider with GameStop. I mean, you have to realize that when you go to GameStop, you're going to get ripped off in one way or another. And even if you get a deal, it was at the expense of somebody else because they traded something of theirs in and got ripped off. So,
go ahead. No, I was going to say, is this something that you guys feel about GameStop, or are you talking about sort of game shops in general?
Well, no, just GameStop specifically. I mean,
notoriously bad.
My personal feelings about GameStop, mm-hmm. at least, mm-hmm. interjecting a little emotion into it.
They almost remind me of a car dealership where, you know, you buy it brand new, it's in perfect condition, there's no scratches on it. You walk out through the door or over the threshold, and now it's all of a sudden, it's got miles on it, it's used. Oh God, we couldn't possibly take it back for the same price. We just sold it to you 2 seconds ago. Mm-hmm. It's just, it doesn't make sense that you can, for one example, and this might not be a good example, but you can buy like an Apple computer from 5 years ago and then sell it 5 years later for virtually the same price because it doesn't lose its value. Now, a game in perfect condition, sealed, let's say it's sealed or barely used, how is that now not worth at least 90% or at least, let's say, 60 or 70% of its original purchase value, if it's within reasonable time, I'm saying?
Well, I can understand that video games work on a different plane than other merchandise. You know, it's all about hype and what people are playing now. And especially now that they put more importance and stress on multiplayer experiences, people are only going to play multiplayer for X amount of time. And I mean, you may get, you know, stray groups now and again. If you want to have a fulfilling multiplayer experience, you got to play that multiplayer pretty soon after it came out. So I could see how it depreciates faster. But even so, like a typical GameStop practice is that if you buy a game and you finish it that night and you bring it back the next day, they won't take it back as a return. So you can't return it. Oh. So you have to quote unquote trade it in, which they'll give you $40 on the $60 game you bought yesterday. Mm-hmm. And then they'll put that game right back on the shelf, sometimes new. Other times they'll put it as used but new, which is like $55 instead of $60. So they're making $15 off of you no matter what. And I feel like the trading in system in general is so exploitive of people. Because, I mean, the worst experience I've ever had was at GameStop because I feel like I was taken advantage of at a weak moment in my life. Mm-hmm. Where I was going through a decluttering stage and I'm trying to get rid of everything and I wasn't playing my PlayStation 2 a lot. So I said, you know, let's try to get some newer PlayStation 3 stuff. So I traded my system, the PlayStation 2 system, about 25 to 30 games, some of them good titles, and I got $100 for it.
Ooh.
Jeez, that's horrible.
Yeah, it was.
Ouch.
And that was during one of their, oh, well, if you trade stuff in, you'll get an extra 10% or 15% or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just, ever since that day, like, I've just been so upset with GameStop and their whole practice. And then they do things like these, where it just, you know, leaves even more sour note in your mouth, you know? Like, you just, it's hard to take. It's hard to see this stuff go on and people get ripped off. Yet they do it, they keep coming back for seconds.
Yeah.
So maybe some healthy competition is just what they need.
Well, I think Amazon gives them a good run for their money because Amazon has the Amazon Marketplace now, and you can go in there and get some pretty quality deals on used titles.
Mm-hmm. No, I know all about that. I bought all of my PS2 and GameCube games through Amazon.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's certainly the way to go. And if you're an Amazon Prime member, it's even better. Because then you'll get all those games shipped to you next day for $4 or 2 days for free. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, no tax most of the time. So, I mean, those deals are like second to none.
But they really don't have any retail competitors since they bought EB Games.
What do you mean, GameStop themselves?
Yeah. Like when you go into a mall, I remember our mall here in Waterbury, Connecticut, they had a GameStop on one half the mall, one of the wings, then they had an EB in the other, and then GameStop bought EBs, and there were two GameStops inside the mall. One focusing on consoles and one, I don't know, they eventually closed the other one, but they have virtually no retail competitor.
Mm. Well, it's true and it's not true because the department stores around here have really been trying to sway business away from the GameStops. I mean, I know you're not going to know much about this, you know, Minnie, and we apologize for excluding you.
No, I'm interested about hearing it.
But, you know, retailers like Kmart, especially Kmart, have been just offering incentives that you'd be foolish to ignore.
Mm.
I mean, and especially if you buy a lot of games, like if you buy games in successive weeks, or even if you just buy like one game every month, you'll never have to pay full price for a game. Because, I mean, Kmart every week has at least $20 coupons on every game you purchase, which is a third of the price. So every game you're getting 33% off, and you can chain those coupons. So, like, for example, this week I purchased, what did I purchase? Resistance 3. So I bought Resistance 3 and I got a $20 coupon, and I paid $60 for Resistance.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the start of the train.
Yeah.
Now next week I'm going to go in and I'm going to buy God of War Origins. I'm going to apply my $20 coupon from this week.
Mm-hmm.
So now instead of theoretically $60, it'll be $40. Plus that game will come with the $20 coupon. So now I just replaced the coupon I used, and I paid $40.
That's a really good deal.
So and then you just from then on it's $20.
Yeah, and exactly. And every game, but the coupons have windows that can only be used for like a month after you purchase it.
Wow.
And it's activated the next week. So if you can buy a game once a month and chain the coupons, you'll never have to pay full price.
Huh. Yeah. It's the same here, actually. Supermarkets are massive competitors to game. I mean, actually, the two game shops that I can think of in this country are Game and GameStation, and they're both owned by the same person, so you can't really get any good deals because they'll both be pretty much the same across the board. But supermarkets are really, really big competitors, actually. You can get them even on launch day. They're much cheaper, like £5 cheaper or something, which... Not doesn't sound much, but it's quite substantial when you're already paying 40 or 50 pounds for a game. Yeah, pounds.
Yeah, but that's what it is, though, right? £40 for a new game, right? Mm, or 50.
Yeah, for usually about 45, like 99 or something. Yeah, or 44.99.
Yeah, because I see through HMV.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, HMV is another one.
Yeah, because they used to be here in the States, but they moved out.
All right.
But I always look at that. At that site when I want to import a European version.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like new games there are always like 40 pounds or so.
Yeah, it's about normal. Between 40 and 44.99, that's about what you pay.
Yeah, so five pounds is a lot.
Yeah, you can add up.
Yeah, but I mean, it just goes to show. And GameStop like almost never runs specials or things like that. They have two sales a year, one right around the Christmas time, and another one for when the kids just get off of school.
Yeah, I don't like the sound of GameStop. No, I wouldn't be buying stuff there.
You're not missing out.
I mean, apparently there is a GameStop in the UK, and I have no idea where it is. I'm looking on Wikipedia, and it says GameStop's in like a worldwide thing, and I've never seen one in my life, so they're lying.
Yeah, it's there somewhere. Just nobody goes to it.
I'm going to seek it out, but I won't go to it. I'll just look at it.
You can go inside but be wise that there's better deals to be had somewhere else.
Definitely, yeah.
Well, let's continue with this GameStop theme and kind of shift focus to the whole reason that GameStop decided to take those coupons out of the games themselves, and that was due to their brand new service that they were looking to start up. Because let's face it, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, the game industry is changing, and it is moving towards a more digitally distributed model, mm-hmm. where the only way you're going to be able to get your games is to download them. And, you know, it's not going to happen tomorrow or next month or next year or in a few years, but it's looming on the horizon. And, you know, GameStop, their entire business is based out of game sales in general. And, you know, in order to still be a company at the end of the day, they're going to have to change. And they realized that, and they went out there and they purchased a game streaming company called Impulse. And they were planning to use Impulse to digitally distribute content when the time comes that their current business model no longer applies. But there's a lot of deals and different agreements that are taking place now that are kind of changing the landscape of digital distribution. So why don't you start us off, Trevor, and kind of give us your take on the digital distribution platform and where you think gaming is going to go in the near future.
Well, you said that it's probably not something that we'll see for, you know, maybe the next month or next year, but the Impulse thing, or at least the service that GameStop's working on, is in beta right now, and they felt like there is as much a need to start it now. So if we take their actions as kind of a barometer of what's going on in the market, as a company with 6,000 stores, with huge investments in selling discs, I think that that puts a lot of weight behind that this is going to happen. It's going to happen a lot quicker than we think it will. And that maybe Xbox 360 or the next Xbox and the PS4 and the Wii U and maybe not even those systems, the systems after those systems, may entirely abandon discs and adopt a streaming service like OnLive. Now, the benefits of these services are obviously you don't have to print anything on discs anymore. You don't have to buy anything, and you can play them at your friends' houses on the internet or anywhere you are, at least in an online situation. So it can create access and, I guess, at the same time allow the companies to control their content a little bit better because you're not downloading anything. So it could really fix a lot of things for the industry, maybe intellectual property-wise and hacking-wise and pirating-wise, and at the same time increase the availability of games for people while saving on resources, I guess. I don't know. It's coming. It's coming quickly, I think. And with OnLive growing and growing and growing and now becoming a threat to GameStop so early on, I think we got to just blink it a couple times. This thing might be here and be the platform.
So what about you, Minnie? What are your views on the digital distribution and the future of gaming in general?
I think it'll definitely open up to a lot more people, I think, because consoles are relatively exclusive in their price and things. I think if people can use, pretty much you can use any PC as long as it can support certain elements. But basically, most baseline PCs will be able to support OnLive. So that's like amazing, really, if you think about it, of how many people can suddenly just go, despite the fact that their PC is functionally useless or something, they can still play really, really high quality games for not really that much at all. So as much as a little part of me is sad because obviously, you know, I quite like having a physical copy, but that's obviously, as we've talked about, it's a generation thing, and eventually kids will never even remember a time where we used to have discs. That'll just be like, really? You had to actually go out and buy something? Crazy. So when, you know, when it's eventually all on downloaded and all streamed, that won't be a problem. So I think, yeah, I think it's a positive move. And for me, I'm not much of a PC gamer, but something like OnLive would definitely convince me to be so, because there are a lot of games on PC that I've never had a chance to play because my computer's always been rubbish. So OnLive really opens up a whole new sector of the gaming market and just brings it to so many more people, which I don't think can ever be a bad thing because gaming's awesome.
Oh, I mean, certainly, I think we'll all agree that gaming is awesome, but I think the future of the digital distribution model is uncertain at best. I mean, if you look at the PlayStation Vita, which is, you know, brand new technology and handheld nonetheless, mm-hmm. it has a physical media port, mm-hmm. and, you know, it's not going to be, you know, optical discs, but, you know, any game that you buy is going to be on a card or something. And if you look at the failure of the PlayStation Go, how it was digital only and nobody bought it, lets people know that I don't think we're quite ready for digital distribution just yet. I mean, especially with internet speeds around the U.S., they aren't very good, especially when compared to the rest of the world.
Yeah,
I mean, in Japan, you can get, you know, 50 megabytes a second, no problem, no matter where you are. And in the U.S., most places, you're lucky to get one or two.
Oh, really? Is it really not that good at all?
Yeah, it's really not that good. It's mainly because of the technology. The technology is older, and they've been trying to push more and more through a cable without upgrading everything to it. You know what I mean?
I suppose, yeah, there's a few criteria that need to be reached before we can truly launch into digital distribution, which is fine with me because I need a few more years of buying physical copies just to get over the sadness. But I suppose internet speeds and just in just getting people to get used to downloading things digitally. I mean, Steam has done that to a certain extent, and Origin, and these sort of things have got people used to not actually owning the physical copy. It's you know, you buy it off the internet and you keep it on your computer. Whereas, I mean, OnLive is a step even beyond that, because you don't even retain a digital copy. It's purely streamed. So, yeah, we have a few steps to overcome first, but I think it'll probably become quite popular.
Yeah, but I do think that there are some issues that come along with digital distribution. I mean, mainly when it comes to the topic of ownership.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, most people don't realize because they think because they have access to the service, they have access to all these games forever, but they don't. And, you know, even games today are becoming more and more entities that aren't owned rather than things that we used to own. Like back in the day, when you used to buy like a Nintendo game or a Super Nintendo game or, you know, a Nintendo 64 game or something like that, you bought the game is yours forever. The company never changed it, they never updated it, they never touched it. You plugged it in and you got the same experience now than you did back in 1995 or whenever that game came out. It's the same consistent experience forever. But games nowadays are updated all the time, and they don't let you play them unless they're updated. So like, you could buy a game and it'll have a day one patch. As soon as you put it in, the PlayStation says, oh, we got to download this. Or the Xbox, you know, says, oh, you got to download this patch. And it downloads the patch, and then you can play it. So theoretically, if they were still supporting that game 20 years from now, it would be a different experience then than it is now. And that, you know, is kind of disturbing. But when you go to a digital distribution method, you don't own the games. And if that service goes down, you don't own the games, and you just poured all that money in for having games, but they have no games.
Actually, yeah, I wouldn't like that. I mean, I'm the sort of person who has gone along on every single game, because my brother's games and my games get mixed up, and I've put an M on every single one of my games, because I'm so intent upon keeping it mine. So yeah, actually, I do have a definite ownership problem.
But that's the whole thing, you know? That's the essence of the service, is that as long as the service is running, and as long as you have access to all the content they provide you, then everything is great. But the second that something's wrong with the server, or the service goes down completely, goes bankrupt and says, thanks for the cash, guys, and leaves, you're out all that money and you have nothing to show for it. So
I mean, you can't play it whenever you want either, because the internet needs to be constant. So unlike, you know, if the Xbox Live or whatever goes down for 3 weeks, it doesn't matter. I can still play what I want.
Well, yeah, exactly. Like what happened with the PlayStation 3 crash, you know, once it was hacked and that was it. People are still playing games. You can go on and play your single-player games, and everything was fine with the world. Because people own the physical media, so that's what people really... I think that's what people really want.
Yeah.
I mean, when you get these digitally distributed or streamed games, you know, there comes that tangibility that comes into play.
Yeah, it actually... It almost creates a dependency on the company. What you're saying is you could have, you know, a crappy day, the internet's out, or... PSN's down, but you can play your PlayStation. You have the option to replay your games years later.
Yeah.
And I guess if OnLive, for instance, only guarantees games, and it says it when you buy it, guarantees the games until 2013. So does that mean that in 2013 will the games disappear? Does that mean that I'll still have access to it somehow? Or, you know, is it just wasted dollars? But I guess it's different for us, because we were talking about this generational thing. We grew up with this. We grew up with having the box in our hands. And you know that box used to be, remember when they used to be huge, the boxes for games, and they got smaller and smaller and smaller? And now they're just like these little tiny cases, and they're eventually just not even going to be there. And I wonder if kids today, the kids who are going to sign on to OnLive, who are living in areas with good internet and actually, can actually enjoy it, are they going to care? Because I know with Steam, I don't care that Half-Life 2 is on there and that it's downloaded on my computer. And if let's say Valve went bankrupt, I don't know if I'd really be that upset because I've beaten Half-Life 2 four times. I've kind of gotten used to the idea that I don't have Half-Life 2 on disc or, you know, Episode 1 on disc. So I think it's learned behavior. You can get used to not having it. You can get used to it disappearing. Because once you beat it, really, do you have to play it again? Do you have to play it over and over and over again for 3 years? There are a lot of issues, and you're right. And the technology is not ready for it. And I didn't even consider that before, that, you know, internet does suck. A lot of people in this country still have dial-up. So, yeah, I just wanted to agree with you on that.
Whoa. Dial-up?
Yeah, but I think there are also another issue comes into play, which a lot of people don't think about. And it's going on right now with Netflix. When people put up their old movies and all that content, you know, like a Paramount Studios, for example, they just throw up all their old movies and say, oh, these are not making any money anymore. So, yeah, you pay us, you know, a couple bucks a month and you can watch them as many times as you want. Mm-hmm. They don't realize that they have a commodity that people want. And that's kind of what happened with Netflix, because Netflix got all these people together and said, hey, you got all these old movies sitting around. You got all these old TV shows sitting around. Why don't you give us the rights to stream them to more customers, mm-hmm. and we'll give you some money off the top. And we'll take care of all the infrastructure and everything else. Just let us use these movies. And they said, okay, that's great. Do what you want. I don't care. Just give me my money. And they said, okay. And they took care of everything. And now Netflix is huge mm-hmm. and making money hand over fist, to the point where all these companies are saying, hey, you're only giving us a small cut of this.
Yeah.
I want more. And I think that, and now all of a sudden, all of these big companies are starting to pull out of their Netflix contracts, and either the price is going to go way, way up, or Netflix isn't going to be around much longer.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that video games is only going to make that much worse.
The difference is that they're charging the retail price for the video games, and there's only sometimes where they have these huge deals and all that to try to entice you into using the service. But they're not unlike any retailer selling a retail box because it's the same price. And I assume the developer or the publisher is making the same cut they would at GameStop on online. But
I don't know if
they go to a subscription-based service like they want to do.
I would say that a subscription-based service will implode within the first couple of years. Just because of the demand that they would get, you know, the money that they would make. I mean, imagine it, even if just Valve, right? Just Valve says, okay, we want to make a subscription service. You pay us $10 a month. We give you access to our full catalog. Play whatever you want. Games saved on our servers. You just log in and you're done. They would get tons of people that would want to do that.
Yeah.
And they would create such a demand for their games that it would be big.
Mm-hmm.
And that would work for just Valve. But if some company, like, just say like OnLive, just said, okay, we're gonna do the same thing, but they get games from everywhere, they're gonna see that OnLive is gonna make a ton of cash because they have access to all these games. You just pay $10 a month and you play whatever you want as long as you want.
They actually have the playback bundle for $10 a month, and it gives you access to 75 games, and they update it all the time. I'm a subscriber to it. I've been playing Fear 2 on the Playback Bundle, Flatout 2, Tropico 3 I was playing on there. So I have access to all of these different games that cost me $30, $40, $50, $60. And when you go into the information area for OnLive, they say in the future we may offer a subscription-based service for the entire service. So I think that Playback Bundle is actually a beta to see if that is the model they want to go for. And it's definitely, I like it. I like the idea of having new games. They had new games all the time. I pop on there and there's a brand new game on there. And, you know, Tropico 4 showed up on Live the second day, I think it was like the 27th. It was just there. So it's quick. It's quick and it's different. It's cheap. $10 a month for 75 games, cheap.
All right, well, that's going to bring us to the end of our program. So I'd like to thank everybody for tuning in, and I'd like to thank our guests for coming on. So why don't you tell everybody how to get a hold of you, Trevor?
Well, you can follow me at Bago Games on Twitter, and you can go to my website, www.bagogames.com.
And what about for you, Minnie? How can the people get a hold of you?
You can follow me on Twitter, at Minnie Liddell, or you can visit my website at Gaming Symmetry, www.gamingsymmetry.com. That's my usual hangout.
Fair enough. And, of course, you can do the same for us. Go to our website, newgamernation.com. Follow us on Twitter at newgamernation, or follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/newgamernations. Please make sure to download our app on the Android store. It's right there on the market. Just search for New Gamer Nation and it will pop right up. Gives you access to everything we post on the website right on your mobile device. And also please make sure to like our iTunes page. Go there, leave a review. It really helps us out, makes everybody see the show a little higher on their lists. So again, thank you for everybody for tuning in. Thank you to our guests for coming on. We hope you enjoyed, and we will talk to you next week.